Hello and welcome to Out in the Bay, our weekly show about gay life from San Francisco. I'm Marilyn Pittman. My guest is one of San Francisco's most successful entrepreneurs. He founded Joie de Vivre Hotels in 1987 with the now legendary Phoenix Hotel in the Tenderloin. His hotels are known for their hospitality, warmth, design, and sophistication, and have won many awards. In 2010, he was a speaker at the famed TED Conference as he presented his book, How Great Companies Get Their Mojo from Maslow. We'll get into that. He's also the author of The Rebel Rules, Daring to Be Yourself in Business and Marketing That Matters. His latest book is Emotional Equations, Simple Truths for Creating Happiness and Success. Chip Conley, welcome to Out in the Bay.
Marilyn, I love your voice. I wish I had a voice like yours, but yeah. I guess I might sound a little...
Are you trying to say I sound better than I look?
You have a face made for radio.
that's what I thought you were saying. Thanks a lot, Chip. Great to have you here. Now, I've really wanted to interview you for so long because I've admired your hotels and admired the work you've done in our community here in San Francisco and your expansion now into being an author and a speaker and really a leader, even an interviewer, which we'll get to. We'll talk about that a little bit later. But I thought we should start talking about just setting the background for everybody to understand. 1987, you find this property in the Tenderloin at Turk and Eddie that's just a rundown hooker hotel. I'll just get to the point. And
you didn't used to work there, did you?
I was that thin in 87? Maybe. I wasn't straight. Oh, yeah. So, okay. Anyway, you took it and you turned it into this rock and roll hotel. The rooms open onto the pool, the outdoor pool, a rarity in San Francisco. And you have famous people like David Bowie, people like this, rock stars. It's the rock star party hotel, yeah, all through the late 80s, early 90s, into the 90s. And I'm just wondering if you could tell me about a little bit about those early days there. What pops in your mind when you think about it?
Well, first of all, I was a youngster. I was 26 years old when I started the company and started at the Joie de Vivre and bought the Phoenix. So I was clueless. I didn't really know what I didn't know. But I did know one thing, and that is I wanted to create a place where creative people could sort of have a crossroads and have a good time together. We immediately started getting, all kinds of celebrities. Our first couple rock stars who stayed there, like the first couple weeks we were open, were Arlo Guthrie and Brenda Lee. Now, they
Those
were not together.
Stars.
They are definitely not. One's folk and one's, I don't even know what you call Brenda Lee. Sort of like, old pop star. Well, she had the beehive and, she's about 4'6". That's how it started. But soon after that, Linda Ronstadt took the whole hotel. Faye Dunaway was hanging out with, her man. And we just, I don't know. We had a lot of people, Nirvana, REM, Pearl Jam. What I loved about it was there was a myth that these musicians trash hotel rooms, and they do. But they usually do that when the hotels treat them badly and disrespectful. So if you check in at a hotel and the first thing they say to you is, please sign this damage waiver, the next thing you want to do is like tear apart the hotel. So we took exactly the opposite approach. We said, listen, what if we treat these people like they're our friends and they're just staying in our home? And that's what we did. And because of that friendly perspective of hospitality, they told all their friends and all the bands started staying there. So it was a lot of fun. It was a burnout as well, but in the sense that it was... 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
It was the 80s. It was, still sex and drugs and rock and roll.
Yeah, still a lot of partying going on, and including me. So I had to actually stop drinking. I stopped drinking and doing drugs for 15 years along that period because I just said, this
You could see where that was going to go.
Yeah, exactly.
With that lifestyle.
That's right.
Anybody that you remember meeting during that time at the Phoenix that was just sort of dazzled you, like, oh, I can't believe I'm standing here talking to you?
Timothy Leary.
Really?
Timothy Leary, yeah. I mean, there are certainly lots of famous people, too, beyond Timothy Leary. But I had a sort of non-psychedelic Timothy Leary conversation by the pool that was about sort of karmic capitalism. The idea of what goes around comes around. Hmm. And he was a big believer in that, and I was a believer in that. And yet we weren't necessarily to a place where I think capitalism was perspective, or there was sort of a more conscious version of capitalism.
Which, we weren't talking about that yet.
No. So it was a great sort of foreshadowing conversation of where I would be going in a few years later.
Which is to become more aware.
Yeah.
And bring that consciousness into capitalism. Yeah. And let the two exist, in fact, help each other.
Yeah.
To be more aware of treating people better, to be not just trampling people to get to the money.
Yeah. Well,
but in fact, to try to create a company, a hotel company, that would serve the people. In fact, that you even put the maids up in the hotel. You gave you treated your employees in a way that was probably unprecedented at the time.
Well, here's the thing about capitalism. You know, they 500 years ago, if you can tell who's the most powerful based on who has the tallest buildings. It's a very male thing. You know, 500 years ago, it was the churches and the cathedrals. And 100 years ago, it was the city hall and the government building. So it used to be the church, and then it was government. Today, the power rests with business because the skyscrapers are what, you know, dominate the skyline. So if that is true, what that means is there's a certain responsibility that comes with being the most powerful. And business needs to, live up to that responsibility. And that's, I've believed that forever, but I've been more of a vocal advocate for it the last 10 years.
Right, since you sort of transformed yourself.
Yep.
You sold your company. Oh, you still have an interest in it.
I still have an interest,
but
I'm not day-to-day anymore.
It's right, if even it became other things, and it's still a hotel group within other names. But you're outside of it a lot more so that you can free yourself up to be more of an author and a speaker and an interviewer and an entrepreneur in a whole new way.
Yep.
You've reinvented yourself here.
I have.
Midlife.
I have.
That's cool.
My own version of a sex change. It was sort of,
instead of a
sports
car.
It was an identity change. Yeah. It was an identity change. Yeah, I did need a sports car.
And a divorce and a younger wife. Yeah.
Yeah. Haven't tried that yet.
Well, you got sober and you stayed sober for all that time. And how...
And why the hell did you start drinking again, Chip? Good question.
Yeah, here we are at a meeting and... Yeah. Not why did you start drinking, but how did that affect you during that 15 years? I mean, you just got clarity. You got more done. You got more conscious in your approach to building this business. I mean, you really started with nothing, and you built it.
Yeah, I built it to.
And
the,
everyone told you, all your Stanford MBA pals told you, don't buy this crappy little hotel in that crappy neighborhood.
Yeah, exactly.
And then it became quite the scene.
Well, and the company became the second largest boutique hotelier in the world. And but long story short is not drinking along the way, you know, we all have coping mechanisms. My coping mechanism when I started the company was like having a drink when I came home or on weekends partying a little too hard. And I just said, you know what? If I'm going to be in a business that's full of alcohol and drugs, which frankly the restaurant and the hotel business
is full of,
has that, and especially if you have a rock and roll hotel, I better like give that up. And I did. And I did. And what it helped me to do is help me get clear about what emotional crutches I had in my life. And they came up for me. And so I, you know, it was an early stage. I was 26, 27 years old. And I was learning, you know, what it meant to actually be my own therapist. And that's really when I started doing it. And that was 24 years ago. And now I write books about it.
But let's talk about your design. I mean, you have such a keen eye. You had at the Phoenix and your other hotels, and you still have input into this, into the organization in terms of the hotels. I recently stayed at the Saguaro Hotel in Scottsdale, Arizona. I was on my own dime before this interview, and I was struck with the design, how every place I sat or walked or looked, I had a pleasing image. Mm. It was really remarkable.
Well, that was just the mirror room.
Yeah, I wish that.
Yeah.
You know, they took narcissistic personality disorder out of the DSM, the doctor's manual, which made me feel a lot better about myself.
That's because we're all becoming one.
Yeah, we'll get to that. Well, so anyway, it's a fancy hotel in some ways. It's a hipster kind of hotel.
Sure.
And I've been to these kinds of places in L.A., the Standard, various places around, and I'm never made to feel comfortable in those places because I'm older. I'm obviously
I'm
dyke. And I'm fat. And so, if I'm cute as hell. And obviously, I'm, you know, somebody. And but I've always been made to feel bad. I mean, at least it pushes that button in myself that feels bad about itself.
Yep.
In this outsider kind of marginalized kind of way.
Tell
as
me
a
more,
gay
honey.
Person. Thank you, sir. Thank you, doctor. And I just have to tell you this, that I'm there with my wife. And we just are made to feel like we are queens for a day. I mean, we were treated royally, even though... The hotel was filled with lots of other kind of hottie types.
Yeah. Well, here's my perspective. I mean,
that's you making that happen, right?
Well,
that's them treating gay people?
Not anymore. I mean, I can't say it's me, but it's the culture I created and the culture we created as a company that continues on. And that is, the name of the company means joy of life in French. So I've got a, you people in the audience can't see this right now, but I've got a little bracelet on and it says create joy on it. So employees are vested with the responsibility of knowing that we're in the business of creating joy. We're not in the business of creating a velvet rope so that some people are cool and some people are not. We're not in the business of being arrogant. We're not in the business of making people feel bad because, you know, of one reason or another. We're in the business of creating joy. And that's all we do. And that's, you know, a very noble thing to do. And I believe that it's one of the reasons I love the hotel business as much as I do, because we help people create great memories. And no doubt, especially in the times we're living in right now, where, you know, the tough economy, you want people to have a little more joy in their life.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Are you sure you didn't take drugs with Timothy Leary?
No, I didn't.
Because that's very...
1960s or something.
But in a beautiful way.
Yeah.
I mean... I don't know that that comes out of the East Coast, that thinking.
No. In the early days of my company, and as I grew the company, people sort of said, oh, that's that California guy, that guy, Chip from San Francisco. What I feel proud of today, I'm actually going to Boston, you know, to speak at the keynote speaker at a conscious capitalism conference. So it's going to the East Coast, and more and more it's going around the world. And so I feel like that's part of my role today, is to be a missionary for this message.
You're listening to Out in the Bay. I'm Marilyn Pittman. My guest is Chip Conley, the founder of Joie de Vivre Hotels, a San Francisco company known for its chic-friendly urban hotels. He's an author and speaker now. His latest book is Emotional Equations, Simple Truths for Creating Happiness and Success. You can find him at chipconley.com. Emotional Equations is filled with actual equations to help us manage our emotions. What led you to developing these equations? What was it in your life that led you this way?
Everything was going wrong. Marilyn, I needed you during that time. I really was a mess. 4 years ago, in 2008, I was in a place where everything that could go wrong was going wrong. My son was off to prison wrongfully. My long-term...
Your adult son.
My adult son. I have a foster son who's 35 now. This was a few years ago. This was 4 years ago, so he was in his early 30s. And he was, you know, he was innocent of something, but he ended up in San Quentin for 8 months until a federal judge let him out and said, this man's not guilty. That was happening. I had a long-term relationship with my partner, Donald, ending, not by my choice. I was running out of cash. Our company was running out of cash. I wasn't taking a salary, and I hadn't for a couple years because, you know, of just the tough times. And more than anything, I didn't want to be the CEO of the company anymore. And that was a really hard thing. You know, I'd been doing it for 22 years. And the last time that a person can actually say, no, I don't want to do this anymore, is when you're needed the most. And we were going into a recession. And it was very clear I needed to be there, but I didn't want to be doing it anymore. It was like I was in prison.
You weren't in love with what you were doing anymore.
I was not in love. I actually dreaded going to work every day. And that's, you know, I'm not the only one, so don't no one
no,
should,
not at all.
No one should pity me for that. But there's, when you're the CEO of a company and sort of the icon and founder, there's a lot expected of you. And it's a 24-hour day kind of existence. And I just didn't want it anymore. And there were moments when I thought, you know, maybe I'll just go jump off that Golden Gate Bridge. And then one of my closest friends, whose name is Chip, committed suicide. And this is not, you know, this is not me being schizophrenic here and having my friend Chip. No, this is, this is a real Chip.
One of your friends.
And he committed suicide. And that woke me up, had me start reading a book called Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl, famous book about a psychologist in a concentration camp and who believes that meaning is the fuel of life. And I came out of that, reading that book, wanting to make it real in my life. And then I had a flatline experience. Soon after Chip had committed suicide, I actually went flatline and died. I had a broken ankle playing baseball, and I had a bacterial infection in my leg related to the injury. And I was giving a speech in St. Louis, and on stage, at the end of the speech, I went unconscious. And a few minutes later, thankfully, the paramedics were there. I went flatline. So that's when I decided, okay, I've got to figure this man's search for meaning thing out before I really die. I didn't die there, but I was in the hospital for a couple of days. They didn't know what was wrong with me. And I decided to turn that book into an equation, not because I'm a math junkie. I don't love math. But math is about relationships. It's usually the relationship of numbers. In this case, I said, maybe it could be the relationship of some emotions. And so if you took that book, Man's Search for Meaning, and turned it into an equation, it would be despair, or feeling bad, equals suffering minus meaning. So in essence, if you're feeling bad in life and all you can feel is the suffering and it feels like it has no meaning, then, you know, that's how many of us feel in our worst times. What it taught me is that if suffering is sort of a constant in life, and that's true when you're going through a difficult time, and meaning is a variable, then if meaning goes up, despair goes down. Mm-hmm. And that was my way of understanding that I had to figure out in this difficult time how to find some meaning in it.
By finding meaning when we are suffering, it's a way through the despair, or a way to avoid despair, is what you're saying.
Correct.
It's a way for us to give value to the suffering and know that it's teaching us something. I think many people, we've all been through moments where, well, we come through a difficult period and then we look back, we're like, oh, I see what that was about.
Right. So the question is, how do you accelerate
that? While it's going on. And to accelerate it.
That's right. While it's going on, how can you understand that there's meaning in it? And so, like, so let me be practical about how to do this. One of the ways I used, and I had a variety of ways I used during that time 4 years ago, was at the end of the week when I just come home and feel completely just spent. I would make a list of the key emotional muscles I'd use that week. Because, you know, if you go back to the gym, now, how often do you go to the gym, Marilyn?
A couple, three times a week.
You do?
I'm lucky.
Good. Okay. So a lot of us actually go back to the gym in January after sort of like partying a little hard in December,
right,
and not working out. And you go back to the gym in January and you start feeling muscles in your body that you didn't know existed.
Right.
This is what happens emotionally. When we're going through emotional boot camp, we start feeling emotions that we don't even know we had, and that we don't even know what to do with. And so once I sort of saw that on a weekly basis, I could make a list of, okay, I felt vulnerable this week. I felt humble. I felt courage. I felt self-reliant. I'd make a list of what are the key emotions I was feeling. I felt anxious. And then I would just look at it and I'd say, okay, what did I learn from this? And as I started to realize I was learning something, I was realizing that my vulnerability and my authenticity and humility was actually making me a more real person, and that within my company, people actually liked me as a leader a little bit more because I wasn't just Chip the rock star, but I was instead Chip the, you know, the person who, you know, has his foibles and challenges too.
Human.
And they, yeah, I was more human, and that made them feel like they could be human. So this process meant I actually started teaching for my leaders in the company and then my line-level staff these emotional equations. And the first one was the despair and meaning one, but then there was a happiness one and anxiety one. And in the book, there's 18 of them and 18
right.
different ones.
Let's talk about the anxiety one. You know, I often call this post-9/11 time the age of anxiety. And one of your emotional equations is anxiety equals uncertainty times powerlessness. Now, what does that mean, uncertainty times powerlessness?
Well, in each of these equations, I went out and I started talking to the specialists in the field, the psychologists or social scientists who just knew this emotion better than anyone. And what I learned from the specialists in anxiety is that there are two primary components that fuel anxiety. The two ingredients of anxiety are what you don't know and what you can't control. And so it's uncertainty is what you don't know, and what you can't control is powerlessness.
Right.
And it's not a plus, it's a times, because if you're feeling them both at the same time, it's combustible.
The greater than the sum of its parts.
That's right. So what I really had to do is say, okay, wow, if I could understand the ingredients for the emotion, maybe I can influence the emotion. Mm-hmm. How can I, when I'm feeling really anxious about something, how can I make a list of the things that I do know and maybe a list of the things that I have some influence over? And maybe I'll make a list of things I don't know and the things I can't influence or can't control either. But if I put it on paper, gosh, what I found is that there are actually things that I do know and things that I can influence that I keep forgetting about when I'm in that most anxious state. And so it was a way of me just helping to understand that if I want to change an emotion, if I want to influence it, it's like changing a recipe for some, you know, for a dish that you're going to serve. Change some of the ingredients, and all of a sudden, the dish changes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I did with anxiety, and with happiness, and with disappointment, and even with jealousy. Ouch. You know,
the shadow emotions that Jung refers to.
Yeah, mm-hmm. The ones that are, you know, we don't want to actually come into contact with. But what Jung also said was that what we're most unconscious of has power over us. And that's true. I mean, so you've seen it. We've all seen it in our friends who are absolutely clueless about some of their worst qualities. And you know, if you even brought it up to them, they're like, what are you talking about? So sometimes that level of unconsciousness about what it is that we're most, sometimes the things that we're most unconscious of are the things that actually are most chipping us out.
And more running us, yeah. Yeah. You're listening to Out in the Bay. I'm Marilyn Pittman. My guest is Chip Conley from Joie de Vivre Hotels. His latest book is Emotional Equations, Simple Truths for Creating Happiness and Success. You can find him at chipconley.com. You admit so many personal things about your own struggles with these emotions in your book, Emotional Equations. And, I find myself reading it and just feeling so like I know you. And this feels different to me than other business-type yeah. books. And I've read, your other books, this one just feels like, wow, you're just kind of bearing your soul to us about all yeah. kinds of things.
Well,
I don't think that's really something we see a lot. I'm not sure. I have to go back to the yeah. gay thing. It's a gay show, right?
Yeah.
I just have to say, wow, are gay men more in touch with their feelings?
Some, I would say.
You're gay that you're more open?
Well, I think that one of the things that we all have to recognize as gay and lesbian folks is that at a young age, we had to come at some point in our life, we had to come to grips with the fact that we were different and we were having emotions and feelings that made us feel abnormal. And made us feel good also sometimes. I mean, so it was this weirdness of trying to understand what was happening inside of you. And for many gay people and lesbians, they got to a place where the only way they could deal with it is to drink. Or having sex, like your real young age. And the way to deal with it was just to try to like either, there's all kinds of, and there's a lot of people become Mormons. Or they become, they get really fundamentalist about something else. Long story short is for me, I just did this deep dive, young enough that I got comfortable with my journey and being curious. I went to a high school that was an inner city high school, and they used to call me Curious White Boy. And so I'm a curious white boy, and I am.
When you were a kid, you were called Curious White Boy?
I was Curious White Boy, and so I have always been curious. And so if you're curious, you're open to being vulnerable because you're willing to say, I don't know the answer. And I want to understand the answer. And I've said that my whole life. And so that's just part of who I am. Could a straight man have written this book? Yeah. I mean, there are a lot of straight men who do their own deep dive and they do men's workshops and all that. I sometimes find those to be just, I don't know, a little, the drumming and all that. It's a little too much for me. But, I do find it really funny when you go to a men's workshop and it's all straight men and you're the only gay man there and it's all men. And then all of a sudden, everything's fine. And until you tell them you're gay. And then they sort of go in one of two directions. There's the ones who are inquisitive to a point of like, oh, I think this guy really wants to actually explore. And then there's the other ones who take the opposite approach. And as much as they're trying to be,
I'm cool with this, but I don't ever want to look you in the eyes.
It's very interesting. So at the end of the day, I think that I don't know whether a straight man could have written the same book. What I do know is that I was in a place in my life where I felt that CEOs and people who are leaders have been on the pedestal too long, and it's actually not healthy for those on the pedestal. It's also not healthy for the rest of us to think that, okay, that those people don't have problems. And so I wanted to be more clear and like, okay, we do have problems, we do have challenges, and we also have solutions if we're willing to actually look for them. And that's what the book is.
Dealt with any homophobia within your organization? Don't want to work with you because you're like the gay guy, gay CEO?
There have been people who I've wanted to hire in the company in the history. I mean, when I left being CEO, we had 3,500 employees. So it's a big organization. There are people who I wanted to hire who I could tell had a challenge with the fact that of our executive committee of 15 people, about half of them were gay or lesbian. And so some people didn't join the company for that reason. We've had owners for whom we manage hotels. We have an owner who's a business partner of mine in a hotel that we own, and he's a fundamentalist Christian. I mean, like Rick Santorum kind. This guy wears vests too. But you know what? I have a good working relationship with him. And is it awkward if I were to bring a boyfriend over to dinner to his house? It might be a little awkward because he and his wife and kids, are like the Ozzy and Harriet lifestyle. But part of my job in life, I think, and part of all of our jobs is to just show up with who we are. I love Oscar Wilde's quote, "Be yourself. Everyone else is already taken." It's very appropriate. And so I'm just being myself.
You're listening to Out in the Bay. I'm Marilyn Pittman. My guest is Chip Conley, the founder of Joie de Vivre Hotels here in San Francisco. You can find him at chipconley.com. His latest book is Emotional Equations, Simple Truths for Creating Happiness and Success. You've been interviewed a lot, but now you're becoming an interviewer. You're looking for the next Oprah?
I want your job.
No, really.
I just, no, I like...
I mean, you are doing, on your website, has a lot of interviews, very interesting stuff. And I'm just curious to see where you're heading, know where you're heading.
I'm just curious. I'm curious in general. I love, you know, I've interviewed, you know, John Mackey, that's founder and CEO of Whole Foods Markets, and Tony Hsieh, who, you know, runs Zappos, and a lot of interesting people. I just like to ask questions. And so but I like to ask questions coming from a place of, okay, let's get behind the mask and let's sort of understand what's going on here. The interviews that are on my site are more specifically business oriented.
Right.
So they don't go too much in that direction.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that my friends, those that, you know, hang out with me, know that I'm not someone who just sort of talk superficially. And
no, not at all. And you're deep. And, you know, when you say get beyond the mask, that itself is just a deep idea for most business leaders.
That's true.
Everybody's busy projecting, you know, with brand consultants and PR people. And not that I disagree with that stuff, but I like it when brands have authenticity. And I think authenticity is at a premium in our culture right now.
That's right.
We, you know, look at our culture. We're clamoring for, well, how can we find somebody who's real?
Right.
Even David Sedaris was written up, you know, his story's real. You know, we're looking for real, you know. Yeah. Well, I don't know what that's all about in the sense that, but I think that there's some underlying desire for finding people to be really real and not sell us something and not project an image.
Right.
And that's what you're trying to do, is get beyond that mask, behind the mask.
That's right.
And unveil yourself, what you do in the book, and just kind of peel back your own layers and be an example to other business leaders, perhaps. Have you had experience with that?
Yes.
Among your peers?
Yeah.
Hey, man, Chip, you're really kind of, wow, going out there, dude.
People want me to sort of be their leadership coach. And I don't do that for a living. But I mean, what I do is I try to be helpful to people and a mentor kind of role, you know, informally.
Sure.
And I just say, you know, like the equation for authenticity in the book is self-awareness times courage. And, you know, most everybody gets the self-awareness piece. We know to be authentic, you got to understand what's going on. But you also have to be courageous. You know, a really authentic person is somebody who is actually willing to do something or stick their neck out courageously when it's just really not politically correct. And so I appreciate the fact that authenticity for me requires courage, and it requires people just doing their own thing and knowing that it's going to be, a road less traveled.
Chip Conley, thank you so much for being on the show.
Marilyn, it's been great.
Anytime. It's fun to just talk to you and learn.
Hi, Out in the Bay producer Eric Jansen here with a quick thanks to all of you who came out to the Front Runners Pride Run last Saturday. It was lots of fun and a big success. Thanks also to two of the local businesses that supported Out in the Bay through the Pride Run. Certified financial planner Dennis Nix, providing investment, retirement, and insurance advice, because our finances aren't straightforward. Learn more online at gayfinancialguy.com. And dentist Peter Farmer of Creelman Farmer DDS, providing comprehensive dental care on Market Street at 15th. Creelman Farmer DDS. Learn more online at cfdds.com.